The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey everyone, it's Duncan Crary. You're listening to The Kunstlercast, a weekly conversation about the tragic comedy of suburban sprawl featuring James Howard Kunstler. Jim is the author of The Long Emergency, The Geography of Nowhere, and The World Made by Hand Novels. For today's show, we have an extra special double-length podcast. I'll tell you more about it in one moment. But first, I want to thank all the listeners who showed up this Tuesday night in Troy for the Kunstlercast book publication party. Lots of great people, lots of fun. Thank you very much. Other listeners, you can find out how to purchase a copy of the Kunstlercast book by visiting kunstlercast.com/book, or you can ask your local independent bookseller if they will be carrying the title. The book should be appearing in stores late November. For today's program, I'm going to be playing the audio from a recent lecture and debate featuring Jim and Transportation Alternatives Executive Director Paul Steely White. The event was hosted at Skidmore College, organized by Kim Marcella of the Environmental Studies Department. It was titled The Long Emergency versus New York City's Resurgency, a debate about the future of cities. Jeff Olson of Alta Planning and Design of Saratoga Springs, New York, moderated the event. And the way this is going to work, each speaker made a brief talk at the podium, and then Jeff, Jim, and Paul all sat down at a table and hashed out some ideas and had some back and forth and some very cordial debate. Thank you very much to Skidmore College, Kim Marcella, Jeff Olson, and everyone else involved with this event and allowing me to play the audio on the show. I've posted information about all of the people involved with this event for the show notes for episode number 179. Please be sure to click the links and learn more about these people and what they're doing.
Oh, what a great turnout. Thank you all for coming tonight. It's good to see so many friends and neighbors and members of the community. This is a really unique opportunity tonight. I get to share this event with two people that I would consider colleagues and friends and allies who have been put their whole lives into what we're talking about this evening. And if you can kind of imagine what we're doing, this is sort of like two beta fish, and my job is to be in between the two fish bowls, okay? We want this to be exciting and interesting, but I don't want to get hurt. So that's kind of where we're at tonight. We have with us James Howard Kunstler, Saratogian, and really someone who has put the entire issue of newer urbanism and smart growth and the future of our society front and center in so many places. With him, Paul Steely White, from New York City, who has been running the organization Transportation Alternatives, one of the top advocacy organizations in the country and in the world, and has helped to transform New York City. So our question that we're here to ask about tonight is, which direction are we going in? And is it the long emergency, title of one of Jim's books, and I'm not even sure if this is a word, but New York City's resurgency. We need a dictionary to check that, but it sounded good when we made up the title. And really the question is, between us, is the world moving in a direction that we think will be sustainable? Or are we beginning to enter into a phase that will not be so? And we're going to debate that a little bit tonight. The format is going to be the two beta fish each get about 15 minutes of swimming around their own bowl, and then we're going to move to the table and do some Q&A, and then we're going to open this up to the audience. So if you're thinking of some really great questions, hold them for just a few minutes and we will get to that. So that is tonight's mission. If those of you who saw the program, and I'll just say this for the record since I know Duncan and others are recording this, we live in a time of either the collapse of our society or the emergence of innovative solutions. This extraordinary evening will feature two of America's most interesting voices, James Howard Kunstler, whose book, The Long Emergency, Surviving the End of Oil, is an apocalyptic vision of a post-oil future, and Paul Steely White of Transportation Alternatives, a leader who's helping to transform New York City into a livable metropolis. Both speakers share a common vision of the need for a sustainable future. The debate will focus on whether or not change is possible in light of our current condition. And just as a matter of introduction, those of you I have not had the chance to meet yet, I'm a partner with the firm Alta Planning and Design. Our company does bike, pedestrian, and greenway projects around the country and around the world, as Kim said. And we, every day, are working on trying to create the solutions to make it possible for kids to walk safely to school or bike to school, to make complete streets and greenways and trails, and the new green infrastructure that will help shape the built environment. So we're all working on this. The question is, are we doing it fast enough? And I, just as a matter of introduction, I think our culture is at a fork in the road, quite literally. And I use this particular fork because you notice it isn't just two, that there may be three or four or more alternatives than we realize. And it's important to think of things that way. It may not just be an either-or debate as we're having here tonight, but it may be a multiple-choice question. At the same time, the future is happening, and it is happening fast, and it's happening around the world. We're going to hear from our speakers tonight of maybe different visions of what that future is, but we're seeing incredible rapid change. This particular image is from Curitiba, Brazil, and is what's called the 72-hour street. It's a mile-long pedestrian street that was built in 3 days by a mayor who came and said, we need to transform our community immediately and become more sustainable. And they literally transformed this from a four-lane road into a mile-long moneymaker for that community. And it is incredible to be there day and night, 24 hours a day. This place is full of people. It's making money. And the people there are very happy and enjoy it. So if Curitiba, Brazil can do the 72-hour street, the question would be, why can't we? And then the other question, as I mentioned, might be, are we doing too little, too late? And we were lucky enough to have Bill McKibben here last year and the great work that he's been doing. This is one of his events, Step It Up. Many of you are actually pictured in this photo. How many people here were in this image? Great. We've got Jim, Barbara, Margo. Those of you who were not in this picture, we're going to demand to know why, and we want to make sure that you get involved, because unless these kinds of things happen, and what's not to like? I mean, here's a chance to be out there with Daryl Hannah. Sorry, Margo, but it made me really happy. That was one of the more exciting environmental moments I had. That's her on the far right of the picture. And for the ladies in the audience, there's Ed Begley. You know, not such a bad catch as well. But really, are we not doing enough? And I think that's what one of the questions I want to ask our two speakers. So in this corner, weighing in at an amount I'm not allowed to say in public, a good friend of ours and someone who has really helped put these issues on the map. And before we start, if you catch the image on the right top right corner, there's a bit of a clue. I'd like us all to sing happy birthday to Jim. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Jimmy. Happy birthday to you. We know it's Jim's birthday because 15 years ago last night, we'd invited him over to dinner and then did what Kim is going to do to us tonight and went ahead and had a kid. So, you know, if Kim has to leave suddenly, please help her up the aisle. Jim, it's all yours.
All righty. A pleasure to be here. Yeah, I've been amused for the last few weeks hearing all the complaints from the media and from people in authority around America to the effect that the Occupy Wall Street gang doesn't have a program or an agenda or a clear idea of what they're doing. This is coming from a culture that is absolutely unable to construct a coherent consensus about what's happening to it or what it's going to do. So I want to talk tonight, it's kind of the very, very, very short outline of the kind of talks I've been giving at universities around the country. I think that we're in kind of a horse race between a disabled money and banking and financial system and the other things that are vying to put us out of business running our culture the way we're running it now. What happened was of course, we got rid of an economy that manufactured and made useful, productive things of value. And we replaced it with a culture that, with a financial sector that grew from 5% to 40% of the whole economy based on new innovated financial instruments that were designed to get something for nothing. The trouble with all those is that they were swindles and frauds, and they've destroyed the banking system. And so money is now disappearing into a black hole from which it will never emerge again. And unfortunately, this was the money that we hoped would be there to build a post-industrial economy or a post-fossil fuel economy or whatever the new economy was going to be. We heard a lot about the new economy over the last 20 years, but most of that was actually a phony story. The real story was that we had an economy based on financialization and getting stuff for nothing, and an economy based on suburban sprawl building, the building of suburban sprawl, and that really became our economy. Now we cannot do any more of either. We cannot defraud people anymore. We've reached the end of our limit to do that and to offload the consequences onto taxpayers, and we've reached the end of the story with the suburban sprawl situation. One more thing about the Occupy Wall Street situation, which I just find amazing, is that it's really not too hard to understand what's required in the situation. What happened in the last 10 years is that the rule of law was evicted from money affairs in America in particular, but in much of the Western world. And we have to put the rule of law back into money affairs, and that includes things like, you know, enforcing the SEC regulations and reinstating the Glass-Steagall Act so that the activities of banks are not injurious to depositors and so that they're not allowed to just permit in wholesale defrauding. Actually prosecuting a few people for misconduct. And I don't know why that's so hard to understand. Or why nobody in the media or the government or any figure in authority can actually state it plainly, but you know it's pretty simple. So the peak oil story is for real, despite what Daniel Yergin, the chief whore, public relations whore for the oil industry, says. The peak oil story is for real, and shale oil and shale gas are not going to rescue us. I get letters from cranks every week, and this is one of their favorite themes. The idea that the earth is a bonbon with a creamy nougat center of oil. And a lot of the drill, drill, drill people believe this. Two nights ago, the Republican debate out of Las Vegas, all the candidates were saying, you know, we could become energy independent in the U.S. if we just drill, drill, drill on American territory. It's a complete lie. It's complete bullshit. It's just not true. We're going to discover that we're going to be getting a whole lot less oil from the people who have been sending it to us, because they're going to be using a lot more of their own depleting oil. The key to understanding what's happening to us is simply this. We're not going to run all our stuff on alternative fuel. And this is the basis of the big wish that's out there now. It's the subject of my next book, which is coming out in July. It's called Too Much Magic, and it's about wishful thinking and technology. And right now we are hugely indulging in what I call techno-narcissism and techno-grandiosity. The idea that we're going to tech our way through this series of problems. And you hear this being expressed in places that are surprising and disgraceful, like at the Aspen Environmental Forum, where I went 2 years in a row. All they wanted to talk about, this is the cream of the environmental movement, the only thing they wanted to talk about there was running all the cars by other means. But notice, there's still the object is to keep all the cars running. And this is the general wish around the country, and that's why I'm very suspicious when I hear words like solutions bandied about, because the hidden agenda behind that term is the idea that we got to find some way to keep on behaving exactly the way we're behaving now by other means. And we're not going to do it. The key to understanding this is that we're going to be disappointed by what alternative energy can do for us. And it doesn't mean that I'm a pessimist or that you should become depressed. What it means is we got to think of other things to do. For example, the people in the Aspen Environmental Forum could be talking about walkable communities. They could be talking about rebuilding the regular railroad system in the USA, not a techno-triumphant fantasy about high-speed rail, which we're not going to do. Why? Because the money's not there. We are facing shortages of capital that are going to be extreme. So we got to make other arrangements. And a lot of this, of course, arises out of the fiasco of suburbia, which became our economy for all practical purposes, apart from the Wall Street module. And suburbia has many characteristics that can be described with precision. But my way of doing it these days to understand what it signifies is that it's the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. And the reason you can call it that is because it is a living arrangement with no future. And to make matters worse, it provokes a psychology of previous investment, which means that you have put so much of your national wealth into this infrastructure for daily life that you can't imagine letting go of it. And that is the chief impediment right now to our ability to construct a coherent story about what's happening to us, because we're not willing to let go of any of these investments that we've made. And there were many other repercussions of it. Another one was that it became a huge part of our economy. And the fact that we can't build any more of it now, the project is over, it means that a great deal of our economy is no longer happening. So instead of solutions, what I propose is that we speak in terms of intelligent responses to what is happening. And you can describe these with some precision too, going around the clock. We're gonna have to grow our food differently. Doesn't mean we have to grow everything close to home, but we're gonna have to grow more stuff close to home. We don't know yet how much. We don't know yet how many more draft animals we'll have to use. These things will be emergent, because societies are emergent by nature. And they self-organize in response to the circumstances of the time and place. So we'll see how that works. We're gonna have to rebuild local networks of economic interdependency, namely local economies. We surrendered our local economies to national chain retail and Walmart and that model of doing business. They're done too, we don't know it yet, you know, but they're done. The 12,000 mile supply line to the other side of the world for all the merchandise, that's not gonna go on forever, despite what Tom Friedman says about globalism, okay? We're gonna have to do schooling different. The centralized school districts are all going to fail. We're gonna have to make a few things in America again, or we're not gonna have anything. We haven't figured that out yet. My guess is it's gonna have a lot to do with water power, hydroelectric power, and generally being on transportation routes that afford water transport. Because what I believe is that this phase of globalism is ending, and America's economy is going to become more inwardly focused again, and that the inland waterways of America, including the Great Lakes, the Mississippi, Ohio, and Missouri River system, and all the canals and things that interact with that, are going to become very important again. And the places along them will become important. There will be a lot of demographic movements, but I don't think it's gonna happen the way people say. I don't think, if suburbia fails, I don't think everybody will move to the city. I think the big cities, the big metroplex cities in our country are all gonna, they're gonna have to get smaller, they're gonna have to contract a lot, it's gonna be very, very difficult, and there will be a lot of losses incurred in the process. They will be lucky if they can contract and reform along their old centers and waterfronts if they are lucky enough to have them. They don't all have them. And the places that are overburdened with skyscrapers are going to be especially in trouble. This actually really means mainly Chicago and New York City. And I'm going to talk about that more later during the main part of the discussion. There are places where people are not going to move. You know, the excitement is over in Las Vegas for everyone but the tarantulas. Phoenix and a lot of the Southwest is toast. Forget about it. They're done. And well, I already mentioned this. What we're going to discover is that all of those skyscrapers that were hoisted up, especially, you know, the 60-story condo buildings that were hoisted up in New York and Chicago over the last 30 years, will prove to be a really tragic collective choice that we made. We'll get into that later. I think that we've reached the end of the game for architectural stunts, like this 80-story Frank Gehry building. You know, one of the reasons that the Starkitects do what they do is because their mission now has become to mystify people. To mystify people and confound them and confound their expectations for how their buildings work and how the city works around the buildings. And the reason they do this is because the more they mystify the public, the more they'll appear to be supernaturally creative, innovative geniuses and wizards that we're not smart enough to understand. So the more they can mystify us, the better it works for them, and then their fees get higher. So we're done with that for reasons I'll talk about later. I think that the action's gonna be shifting to small towns, smaller cities, including a lot of the cities around here that are exemplary of this process. They're places that have become depopulated. This is Troy, New York. They're places that have been deactivated, but they contain the kind of infrastructure that is scaled to the energy and capital realities of the future. Whereas places like New York, Chicago, virtually any really huge American city is going to have problems with that. These places are sitting there empty, waiting to be reactivated. A lot of them are on our inland waterway system, and they're going to be important again. It's very hard to imagine because they've been dead now for most of our lifetimes, but they're coming back, I believe. And that goes for the small towns, too. I think what we're going to see is that the successful places will need one particular advantage. They're going to have a meaningful relationship with food production. Like I said, not all of their food, but a significant amount of it. And we're also going to have to, the infrastructure for the local networks of economic interdependency, in other words, main streets and the things that activate main streets, they're waiting there, waiting to be reactivated, sitting there all over upstate New York and the Midwest and the Great Lakes. It's not enough to build green buildings. And there's a favorite phrase that the people in public relations use to talk about their clients. They call it blowing smoke up their ass. Well, we're blowing a lot of green smoke up our asses. And it's not enough to build green buildings. In fact, I've been to presentations where many green skyscrapers are proposed. And there's no such thing as a green skyscraper. It's a contradiction in terms. What's really more important is how the buildings are deployed on the landscape and how they relate to each other and to the urban organism that they're forming, whether it's a small urban organism of a town or a village or a larger urban organism of a city, which is many neighborhoods and maybe a special use business district. So that's much more important than being green, which, we're greenwashing ourselves to death. I've been associated with the New Urbanist Movement for 20 years. I think they performed a wonderful service for their culture, and their great achievement was not building Seaside, Florida, or Kentlands, Maryland, or many of the demonstration towns, although many of them are wonderful. The great achievement of the New Urbanists was they dove into the garbage can of history, and they retrieved principle and skills that were necessary to understand how to design and assemble a human habitat that's worth being in and that has a future and that is scaled appropriately to the realities of the future. So, we've made a lot of mistakes in Saratoga over the issues of taste and style. A lot of good things have happened in Saratoga, by the way. As someone who's traveled around the country a lot, I want to tell you, pound for pound, Saratoga has gotten more good redevelopment for a town of its size than almost anywhere in the country. We've got just a huge amount of redevelopment and infill in our downtown, and most of it is great because they're getting live bodies living in town. Even if they're expensive condominiums, sooner or later, in the natural course of things, the expensive real estate becomes the affordable housing. You can't really provide an artificial commodity called affordable housing because that means you're trying deliberately to build something cheap and shitty. And people, that's not a successful strategy. But what we do in Saratoga with design review is that our design review is based on taste and mood and style and whether somebody's wife yelled at them that night and made them feel bad. you know? And that's not what you base design review on. Design review has to be based on standards of excellence. And we have never had a clear body of stated standards of excellence on our design review, so we get stupid decisions out of there. A lot of people don't like the new infill buildings downtown on Railroad Place and et cetera, and they complain about them. And I think that there are things that are worth complaining about, but one thing is they're actually not too big. The other thing is that the architecture, you know, with architecture and the detailing of the exterior of the buildings, we're not that good yet because we've missed a couple of generations of doing good work. So we're kind of like a stroke patient in rehabilitation, trying to creep back to normality with our architecture. So the architecture is kind of weak, the proportioning's not great, some of the materials are dumb, but the relationship of the buildings to the street is generally pretty good in those new developments. So I'm all for them. And that's it. That's all I got to say, and we'll get on with it.
I'm really sorry. I told Jim he didn't have to hold back tonight, and you know, no reason to be reserved and shy and not speak his mind, but he felt the need to do that. Just to prove the point of whether or not the glass is half full, I think we might say the glass is at least half full, and it's full of beer, which is a really good thing. Paul Steely White, this is sort of like point counterpoint, so I'm going to welcome you up here, and feel free to take Jim right on. Go ahead.
Is that the best you got, Jim? I mean, I live in Brooklyn. I mean, I'm used to tough characters. We agree on a lot. You know, was Amory Lovins at that meeting in Aspen? He's been talking about hypercars for 20 years. And where's my jetpack? That's what I want to know. When I was a kid, I was promised a jetpack. Never got one. Okay, so transportation alternatives. We were founded in 1973 by many contemporaries of Jane Jacobs. Any Jane Jacobs fans out there in the audience? Absolutely. Our illustrious transportation commissioner, Jeanette Sadek Khan, who I have a slide of here in a moment, who has made so much happen in New York. She and I were co-awardees this year of the Jane Jacobs Medal from the Rockefeller Foundation. So there's me telling you to clap for me. So thank you. It's wonderful, and things are happening. So Transportation Alternatives was founded by folks who also were very into green markets. At the same time they founded TA, Transportation Alternatives, they founded the wonderful green markets we have in Union Square and elsewhere around the city. So they understood at this time when the Clean Air Act was getting passed, you saw this flowering of environmental consciousness, that it wasn't just about transportation or a livable street, but also about food production. And some of our staffers at TA are really getting into that. Some of them around here, actually. So who's this? Clearly, that's the FDNY. The guy in the middle is named, who knows, maybe some of you know who this is. Not you, Jeff. I know you know who this is. Okay, so that guy may be the world's foremost designer of friendly human habitat. You might call him a Jan Gehl from Denmark, from Copenhagen. You might say that this guy is in the human habitat restoration business. He talks a lot about the invasion of cities by the motor car. He's not an anti-car crank, not that there's anything wrong with that, but he talks about achieving a better balance on our streets, and he's the guy who made Copenhagen into this wonderful people-oriented place where you can walk, you can bike, you can hear mothers calling for their children, a very healthy city, and he's made this happen around the world to varying degrees. And the best thing we ever did at TA, I mean, we do a lot of good things. We organize, we write letters to the editor, we meet with editorial boards, we issue reports, we go to our community board meetings. Probably the best thing we've done in the last 5 years is get this guy, Jan Gehl, to New York and watch him do his thing. He's an architect, urban designer. When he was a student in Copenhagen, his wife was a psychologist, and she said, "Why are you guys so concerned with your big Starkitect phallic buildings? Why don't you pay attention to what's happening, how people interact with the built environment? How do you design a street to maximize human interaction?" You know, the way a city's built, Jan discovered, the way streets are designed, have everything to do with our happiness, how often our children play, how well we know our neighbors, of course, how much fossil fuel we burn has everything to do with street design. But you'll see more books and research coming out in the next few years about how this intimate relationship that we have with our built environment has really been ignored. Yan says that a good city is like a good party. You never want to leave. And he also said, famously, we shape our city and our cities shape us. You guys have heard about the national obesity epidemic. You can't ride your bike to school. That's certainly been somewhat true here in Saratoga Springs. Many of us are depressed, and there's research emerging that's showing that when we can enjoy each other's company in quality public space without cars making so much noise that we can't even hear each other, that this really can change us. And I think that's the optimism. If I have a message for you tonight, it's that what's happening in New York on the streets is not just helping us burn less fossil fuel, it's actually, I think, giving us clues to that emergent urban ethos that is really, I think, at the core of our future, if we have a future. This is Times Square, of course, and it looked very different just a few years ago. It was choked with cars. And people said if you did this, the sky would fall. You would have Carmageddon in Manhattan. And of course, that's not what happened. The worst thing that's happened is that retail rents have tripled since this happened, because so many people are flocking. Even New Yorkers now go to Times Square. This is happening throughout Broadway, not as far north as here on Broadway, but the whole of Broadway from, you know, from around this area down to Herald Square, Madison Square, Union Square, it's become this really emblematic street that is showing, much like the Curitiba Street, what is possible. And I'm heartened by the fact that 40 million people visit New York every year, and they go to this space that used to be crowded with traffic, and now they see a real town square. I mean, sure, it's over-commercialized, but it's really a beautiful place, and we're getting more of them every day. What's also happening in New York's recent transformation are our bike lanes, of course. 250 miles of new bike lanes, some of them like this, cycle tracks where they pull the parking lane out. Those are parked cars floating there, acting as a barrier, of course, to mixed cars in their car lanes. This is Prospect Park West, about a half a block from where I live. And you see on this lane what you never used to see in New York, which is families cycling together, kids biking to baseball practice, people recognizing each other as they're biking on the lane and see someone on the sidewalk and saying, oh, hey, friend, how you doing? Maybe they talk politics. So this is the agora that the Greeks talked about, that they loved. And there are many people who posit that part of the reason why our democracy is in the toilet is because we don't have places like this to meet and chat and have that glue of what a city is all about. This is cute. Back in 2005, we started just sort of guerrilla style reclaiming parking spaces. We had some colleagues in San Francisco who did it much better than us a couple months later, and they put sod down, so we copied them. And now it's Parking Day, this international phenomenon where people of all walks of life do all manner of things in parking spaces. We had Shakespeare in a parking spot in New York this year. Kids playing chess, parking bikes, shrinks setting up shop, like Lucy from Peanuts. And it's really great. And now this has actually become institutionalized. Thanks to our leadership at the New York Department of Transportation, we now have these pocket parks popping up all over the city, giving people a little taste of the good life where there used to be just cars. On-street parking in New York, if you add it all up, it comprises about 14 central parks. So just a few spaces here and there on every other block, you're really talking about major transformation. So that's yours truly piloting the family truckster there. That's my wife, Zoe, in the box. You can't see my three-year-old daughter, Anna. I think Zoe's trying to shield our daughter from the shouts and yells of those protesters. When you think about protests in New York, you probably think about Zuccotti Park. This is the 1% protesting a bike lane. Most of the bike lanes in New York have been very popular. We've had somewhat of a backlash. much of it ginned up by the media and instigated by some very entitled and empowered individuals. These people are mostly friends and neighbors of Iris Wineshaw, the former DOT commissioner, who just doesn't like the fact that the new commissioner is getting all this positive attention. And she had the audacity to build a bike lane on her street, the old commissioner's street. And the old commissioner also happens to be married to Charles Schumer, your wonderful senator. So if you do one thing tonight, as a result of this talk, write a letter to Chuck. He loves to bike, by the way. I've ridden bikes with Charles Schumer, but he's got NIMBY syndrome, and he doesn't like this bike lane on his street.
Me and his wife doesn't like it.
I don't know how what their domestic arrangement is. He's lobbied city council. He's hassled Mayor Bloomberg about getting that bike lane removed. By the way, that bike lane is on a street that used to be three lanes of traffic. Now it's two. It works just fine. There's no backups. It's a much safer street for everyone. We've seen this all around the city where you have a bike lane. Of course, bike injuries and fatalities go way down, but it's safer for everyone. Traffic slows down. Pedestrians have a shorter crossing distance. You're opening up sight lines. So I think as more data comes in, we're going to see, I think, even more public support. And speaking of public support, that is Councilwoman Melissa Mark Viverito. She represents East Harlem. And the way that we've, I think, managed to turn the corner and beat back some of this pushback is through good old-fashioned organizing. She's holding 1,000 handwritten letters to Mayor Bloomberg saying, hey, where's ours? We live up here in East Harlem with the highest asthma rates in the city. Some of our streets are the most dangerous in the city. Where's our bike lanes? Where's our pedestrian plazas? And this is providing really crucial political cover and, of course, catalyzing the expansion of a lot of these facilities. It's becoming an equity issue. So now we're starting to see in many neighborhoods a race to the top, where people see what it's like in Park Slope with their livable streets. Can't we have them too? We've been succeeding too in the media. Every year, since as long as I've been a member or staffer at Transportation Alternatives, maybe you guys do this here too, you have a commuter race, right? You pit a cyclist against a driver, against maybe someone taking transit, and they go from A to B, and you see who wins, who gets there first. The cyclist always wins. We don't rig it. It just kind of happens. Any bikers in the audience tonight, by the way? Okay, I thought it was a nice crowd. And so last year, we convinced the Today Show to do this, and so we were like, who's going to ride a bike? And they said, Al Roker. And we said, okay, great. Does he know how? And they said, yeah, he's expert. You know, does he need a bike? No, he's got his own bike, whatever. So Al shows up with this brand new Brompton folding bike and really, really tiny tires. And if you know anything about New York City, there's lots of potholes. And those bikes are notoriously difficult in potholes. But Al rode just like he knew exactly what he was doing. It was like the tortoise and the hare. He stopped for 8 minutes because he recognized his eighth grade high school English teacher at 61st Street and Broadway. It was this very Jane Jacobs moment where this very spontaneous, wonderful encounter. And I'm behind Al, I'm just like, hurry up, we're gonna, you know, we can't, you know. So he still beat Matt Lauer and Meredith handily. And it was a wonderful day and it was a great thing. But, you know, is that relevant to Phoenix? Is that relevant to suburban America? I mean, a lot of what we've done in New York has already started to migrate to San Francisco, Chicago, and these big cities are now sharing best practice like never before. And so we're really starting to see that race to the top. But most of America is much lower density, of course. And I'm with Jim. You know, it's not going to be about magic technology saving the day. It just might be about taking the bus. And the bus ain't so bad, especially when you have a real-time tracking system via your smartphone, as they're now piloting in Brooklyn here on the B63. A big problem with making transit viable in low-density towns, of course, is that the frequency of services tends to be fairly low. But if you have a smartphone and you know that you've got 20 minutes before the bus arrives, you can start to plan your life around transit a little more effectively. The future of this, of course, is going away from just this passive getting information on your phone about when your bus is going to arrive and getting more active about it. So your phone is actually signaling to the transit service when you want to go, where you want to go. This kind of dynamic ride sharing or dynamic smart paratransit is being piloted in cities here in America and in Europe. And in the UK, there's already a service called Avego that is partnering up people with space in their car with people who need rides, and it seems to be working very, very well. And you can see how a smart paratransit type application where you have riders all aggregating their demand data, and then a computer crunches it and it dispatches these smart vehicles, and that you can, by doing so, take many individual trips that people would have made by car and start to aggregate them into this form of transit that may be viable in the city. And if that doesn't work, we can do what millions, if not billions, of people do around the world, which is rely on informal paratransit. This is how most Latinos get around Atlanta, a city that should have had good transit but didn't for various reasons, mostly xenophobia. But this is, I lived in South Africa for a while, working there, actually throughout Africa. It's really interesting to see the informal taxi industry and how responsive it is to demand. This isn't what Jim would call happy motoring, but it might get you from A to B. And my last few slides, this is perhaps the reason why I'm optimistic about the future. What's that H.G. Wells quote about every time I see a human... Every time I see a grown person on a bike,
I feel there's a future for the world.
Yeah, I don't weep for the future of mankind. More than anything else, public bike share is putting normal people on bikes. We're seeing in Paris, mode share went from like biking being like 0.5% of all urban travel to like 5 or 6 just within a few years. And Alta Bike Share won the contract for New York City. So next year, if all goes according to plan, we're going to have 10,000 bicycles on the streets at 600 of these stations. And the first half hour is free. After that, you start incurring a somewhat nominal fee. But the DC bike share system, fairly modest in size, but already, Jeff was telling me earlier today, 1 million trips a year with the DC bike share. And so New York system is going to be much bigger. And you can imagine what bike share starts to do for the suburbs if you think about a trunk bus line or even a rail line, and how bicycling enables that transit station to capture many more potential riders. This is a map of the New York City subway system, and the green represents a fourth of a mile around those stations. The red is 3 miles to the station, and a 3 mile bike ride takes, what, 10 minutes. So if you enable safe bicycling to transit, now you're also like folding space and making transit much more viable. So I think when we talk about what's appropriate transportation technology for lower density cities, solutions like this, I think, are going to help us stave off the long emergency. But more than these kinds of applications, I think it's going to be working the politics. And my last two slides are about that. What made our country so car dependent? There's a great book out by a gentleman, Peter... with Fighting Traffic, have you read this, heard about this? It's a book that chronicles the arrival of the motor car in urban America and how streets that were formerly very convivial and walkable over time became car-dominated. And this didn't happen by itself. Of course, you've all seen Who Killed Roger Rabbit, the streetcar lines being ripped out and so forth. But there was really this alliance of, you know, oil, automobiles, later suburban developers, that are really now protecting the status quo. And this is part of the problem. There's this real disconnect between what people want and what politicians think they want. And by the same token, you know, the converse is true, as you can see here. So what we do at TA is try to break through that. And one way we're doing that is by building coalitions. This is Jeanette Sadek Khan at the lectern. This is just last month, was it, Jeff? In New York City. The launch of the bike share project. And this photo is telling because to Jeanette's right is Dan Cantor, and he's the head of the Working Families Party in New York City. To Jeanette's left, sort of standing behind the woman in glasses there, is Kathy Wild, and she pretty much represents finance and real estate in New York City. This is probably the only time that they're ever gonna stand together at the same press conference. And kudos to Jeanette for lining up the left and the right. That gentleman in the hoodie over there, that's Dennis Crowley, the CEO of Foursquare. A lot of people in New York are banking on the tech sector to provide the jobs and economic driving engine that Wall Street is no longer doing and is probably not going to do in the future. We have our board meetings at Google. There's a lot of tech town in New York, and they all love to ride their bikes. So this sort of marriage of tech, labor, enlightened business, I think is going to be really key to lining up the politics so that we can start to reinvest in some of the things we're talking about here. Last weekend, I rode with my daughter to Zuccotti Park, and it was in the morning, and Anna said, "Why are those kids sleeping in the grass?" And we poked around for a little bit. I just wanted her to see that. I'm not sure if she'll remember it or not, but I think what's happening down there is it's pivotal. Our office is all abuzz. We have a lot of young radicals working at TA. And it's really interesting to see the kind of communal culture that's evolving down there. Everyone's sharing things. But to me, what's most striking isn't really what's happening in Zuccotti Park, but what's happening in the larger culture in New York City. And you see it reflected in the media, where you might even think that the old American dream of getting a car and getting the girl and getting the house in the suburbs is really starting to fall away to a new American dream that isn't so much about stuff or things or getting status and fulfillment from a car, but it's about a lifestyle. It's about being connected. It's about relationships. And maybe you don't need a car. Maybe you don't need to own much of anything. Maybe you can share a car. Maybe you can share a bike. You can share a street. So I think we're seeing this new shared culture emerge in New York, mostly among the youth, but I think it's very inspiring. And I think if we can continue this, we can keep this momentum going, I think we are starting to see what may be the seeds of a brighter future. Thank you.
A big part of me feels we could all leave tonight and feel like we really had a great time. And maybe we should do that. But I think, quite honestly, we came here to get into some more discussion, and we're gonna make that happen, and that's kind of my job. Certainly, those of you who have questions, we'll try to get to those in just a few minutes. But I literally get to sit between these two now and challenge them to respond to some of the things that we talked about in the opening reception and some of the things people have asked me coming here this evening. So we're going to shift over to dinner for just a moment. And I just want to thank both of them, maybe a round of applause again, for getting us to this point. By the way, those of you who don't know it, that's Five Points Market in our neighborhood here in Saratoga Springs, and that was after 9/11. And it's an image that has really stuck in my mind about what the spirit of this community and this country can be. And I think that's really, you know, what we want to talk about is how do we get to that point. I'm going to open up with a question that Jim asked me to ask him. Isn't that interesting? And it has to do with, why are skyscrapers a problem? If building better urban communities are necessary, and we know that we need to build taller to make places like New York and Chicago work, what's wrong with skyscrapers, Jim?
Well, there has been a lot of thinking about this over the last several years, and some of it, I think, very mischievous. One was David Owen's sort of seminal article in The New Yorker about 6 or 7 years ago. Called Green City, or was that, do you remember the title? Green City. Anyway, and David Owen's a lovely fellow and a very good writer, as practically everyone at The New Yorker is. And David Owen's idea was that New York was the greenest place in America because you could stack so many people up on one building footprint in tall towers. And so that sort of started the ball rolling with this a meme, you know, an idea, an infectious idea through society that, oh, of course, stacking people up in towers will be the way that we'll build our cities. And then last spring, Ed Glaser, a Harvard economist, which is to say a person of very limited intellectual abilities and vision.
Well, that's Skidmore, right? Yeah, okay, good.
Ed Glaser, I don't know if he has any children here, published a book called The Triumph of the City. And his idea was that the future of the city was going to be all about giant tower cities of stacking people up in apartments. So this has now become the dominant thought among people who think about cities in America. And I think it's completely false and completely wrong for the two following reasons. And they're not the ones that most people would think of. You know, it's not directly the energy thing directly. The first reason is they'll never be renovated. Okay?
we're not going to have the capital to renovate all these mega structures. And no, but there's no conversation going on about that at all. For one thing, that capital's not going to be there. We're not going to have the money to do it. And for another thing, we may probably not even have the modular fabricated building materials that are necessary to renovate buildings, including things like manufactured sheetrock and a lot of copper wire and all the other things that you need to accomplish that. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, in the same vein that suburbia was an experiment whose outcome we have not seen completely played out yet, so is the condoization experiment of the deconstruction of real estate rights so that you build a gigantic megastructure and then you, at a great profit, deconstruct the real estate so that everybody owns a little piece of it in the form of an apartment, and then you form a homeowners association, and the homeowners association takes care of the building, okay? And the model seemed to work really well while the country was accumulating more and more debt and thinking that it was richer and richer. When you think you have more money in your society and you can keep on doing that, you can keep on deconstructing real estate. We've never seen a situation where the society is actually becoming less affluent and is involved in a comprehensive economic contraction, and all of a sudden you have a lot of giant megastructures in which 13% of the people are having their piece of real estate foreclosed, or they're not paying their homeowners association fee. And then there's nobody there to take care of the building. And that's never been seen before. There's absolutely no discussion going on about it in relation to the banking fiasco that's now underway. And I promise you that the condominium process, the legal and financial process of condoization, is going to turn out to be a huge fiasco as it becomes necessary for us to have a smaller economy.
Wow. At the risk of making Paul feel like a deer caught in the headlights, Paul, you live in New York City. You spend a lot of time in skyscraper world. What do you think? Is that?
Well, I'm going to plead ignorance on this one. I'm not a buildings expert, but I will say that the majority of New Yorkers live in three-story buildings. And if we have to rip down a couple shoddily built condos, I don't think it's going to kill New York City or the density that makes it thrive. You know, we have buildings in New York that have been maintained pretty well for decades, many since, you know, the 1800s. And I haven't seen any evidence that we're not going to have at least the meager resources to keep most of our building stock in good shape. If you look at many second and third world countries that have skyscrapers, they mostly do okay. And so I think this is one of those areas where we're going to muddle through. I think if you look at the majority of New York's land area as well, it's pretty well built three-story structures, like much of Paris, which has been there for hundreds of years. So I'm going to ask that we just sort of get off this topic because you know, I'm more of a transportation guy.
Great. I'm very happy to do that. I'm just trying to give equal time here. Let me ask a completely different question since we're on a college campus. I'd like to ask you both to say, what should a group of college students do or an individual college student do? And Paul, I'll let you start this one.
That's funny. I was a graduate student at the University of Montana, Missoula in environmental studies, studying grizzly bear habitat. Thanks to guys like Jim, I got interested in other things. But at the time, I was doing an internship with the local bike ped planning office. There's a lot of action now at the local level. There's no shortage of projects to get involved with. Lots of interesting town gown disputes, at least down in New York with NYU. And we're actually doing a lot of work now with Columbia and NYU students, many more of whom are now riding their bikes around campus, more of whom are interested in doing car-free play streets on the weekend or just getting involved and maybe even going to their local community board meeting. I mean, that's where the local political action is in New York. Our 59 community boards are the closest proxy to local democracy, and a lot doesn't happen in New York without your community board's approval. So, you know, you guys remember Star Trek, right? Like the basic storyline of those was right, these hostile, irrational aliens are eventually swayed with reason, right? That doesn't really happen in New York, and I don't think it happens around the country. Great ideas don't get done because they're great ideas. They get done because people show up at boring meetings and say why they support something. So show up.
Great. So with that said, Jim, same question. If here's a group of college students here tonight, if you had to offer them some advice, what might it be?
I think it's very important for young people to perhaps rethink what the nature of work is going to be in the next 30, 50 years. And I don't think it's a tragedy that there are going to be far fewer cubicle jobs working for giant corporations where you become kind of a termite in the termite mound. In fact, I think it's going to be much more important to have to find a role in your community that is both an economic role and a social role, and that there are going to be a lot of opportunities for young people to get into business, and that business will be specifically the rebuilding of local and regional economic networks of interdependency, the very ones that were destroyed by Walmart and things like it. And there are going to be huge opportunities for rebuilding them at multiple layers, at a fine grain of operation. I think what we're going to see, which will be another huge surprise to a lot of people, is that agriculture is going to come closer to the center of our economic life than it has for generations. It doesn't mean that we're going to become a society of agricultural peasants, but it means it's going to be more important, and it's going to require more people, and it's going to require more human attention to produce the food that we need, because we're not going to have the fossil fuel inputs. And another thing, we're not going to have the capital inputs. One of the biggest inputs for agriculture is money that they have to borrow every year to get the crops in. And there's going to be less money. Once again, the capital scarcity issue asserts itself. So we're going to see the management of agriculture and food production at all levels are going to require a reorganization, and a lot of people are going to have to become interested in that. It's already happening. You know, out around in the hinterlands of Saratoga, there are young people who are actually very excited about becoming organic farmers and raising lambs and doing all the other things that you can do out in that derelict farmland that's been out there with the pastures and the cornfields growing scrub over them for the last 20 years as the dairy shuts down. So that's basically where I think we're going.
And I'll put a plug in. How many people here shop at our local farmers market on Wednesdays and Saturdays? Great. We're doing the right thing. Paul, you wanted to add to that.
Yeah, on that topic, one of the more exciting things happening in New York's labor sector is what's happening in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, where you have a real renaissance of light manufacturing. People are actually making stuff again in New York City on the waterfront. And it's largely also part of this shared culture. There's a little studio where, actually a large studio, where you have four furniture makers all sharing the same equipment, all meeting a lot of emerging demand in New York for locally produced, you know, sustainable hardwood products. My good friend Andrew Kimball, who runs the Navy Yard, is seeing demand skyrocket for these kinds of facilities. And so the city is actually looking at rezoning other parts of the waterfront, providing some incentives so that we get more of this kind of light manufacturing, which is providing a lot more jobs. McClure's Pickles is a great example, too, this pickle maker that's in Detroit and also in Brooklyn. So the food, the local food revolution is also part of this.
And, you know, you see things like that here, Serata Bikes. I don't know if anyone here from the company, if you would like to give me a sample, I'm completely ready anytime. It's great to see things made and built here in town. And also, I'll put in another plug. There are a number of people here tonight from local organizations ranging from Saratoga Plan, Barbara and many others that have helped make that, Libby, others that have made that successful, Healthy Transportation, Doug Haller and others that are here tonight. If you're here from either of those organizations, certainly Sustainable Saratoga. There are a lot of groups that are working locally to try to make this kind of change happen, and I would encourage you tonight, if you're not part of what's going on with those organizations, what Paul is talking about, the kind of advocacy that's happening in New York, only happens because people like those of us here tonight get involved and make that kind of change happen. So that was my two cents on that subject. Not only did I get to referee, but every once in a while I get to say something. So I'll fight for a word in edgewise. Let me completely skip to a totally different question. You can use your imagination, guys. If you were, say, the mayor of New York City or maybe the president of the United States or some other lofty title like that, what would you do about all this? And I'm going to, again, let Paul start off. You can pick your job title, and then you can decide what you'd like to do. Go ahead.
Well, I think what Jim said earlier, I'll just go right to president.
Good.
Yeah.
Nice pick. Election day is soon. All right.
I mean, there's so much denial happening about, you know, I'm not sure if I believe that we're going to totally run out of oil on the scale that some do, but gas is definitely going to get a lot more expensive. I'm an avid reader of Jim's blog, and he talks a lot about no one is being intentional about this contraction that we're in. And this is actually becoming pretty fashionable among even Harvard economists to talk about the structural change that's happening in our economy. It's not a cyclical thing. You know, suburbia is not coming back as a driver of our economy. So what's going to replace it? The first thing I do, instead of giving more auto bailouts, is get Detroit making buses. We can't even buy buses in America anymore. We have to get them from Brazil or Europe. Earl Blumenauer, one of my heroes, I would probably install him and his cronies right at the DOT. He's making light rail cars now in Portland, Oregon. Anyone go to Portland familiar with what's happening there? I mean, it's really amazing. I mean, what's happening in Portland needs to be propagated throughout the country, not just in terms of local manufacturing, but obviously transit, just that whole spirit of making stuff that we need. So I would find a way to clone Portland nationwide if I were president.
Fantastic. We got notes on that. Cloning Portland. Jim, go right ahead.
One of my pet peeves or pet ideas is that we desperately need to rebuild the regular railroad, passenger railroad system in the USA. Well, we should not waste our time and capital and effort with fantasies about high-speed rail. We may build a few of them between, you know, San Francisco and L.A. or Orlando and Tampa, kind of a dumb route, but we may do that. But we have a railroad system that's lying out there rusting in the rain that was the envy of the world a few decades ago. And it's sitting out there waiting to be fixed. And it's disgraceful that people who call themselves political progressives have not dragged this issue into the political arena. Why was it not part of the 2008 campaign? It's one of the reasons that, and I say this as a registered Democrat, it's one of the reasons that the Democratic Party is falling into complete irrelevancy, because they cannot get behind an idea like this. Now, let me tell you why this is important. First of all, we desperately need it because happy motoring has a much shorter horizon than people realize. Secondly, it will benefit people of all classes. Thirdly, it's a project that we can do to demonstrate to ourselves that we're capable, competent people, that we're part of a capable, competent society that can then go on and do the other great tasks that we have to face, reforming and rebuilding agriculture, reforming and rebuilding commerce, reforming and rebuilding the school, some kind of a school system, et cetera. These are enormous tasks. And because the project of fixing the railroad system is relatively easy compared to these, we need to do that right away to build our morale and our confidence up.
Interesting answer. And here's a trivia question. Can anybody in this room tell us what the first man-made thing, human-made thing was that went more than 100 miles an hour? Nobody? I'll give you a hint. It's a local history question. Anybody? No, close though. It was a train. It was the train from Albany to New York City, went 100 miles an hour more than 100 years ago. In the late 1800s, we had 100 mile an hour high speed rail. It now goes 92.
Yeah, no, I want to say one more thing about that.
On a good day, right?
One more thing about that. You know, with this, apropos of our ridiculous preoccupation with technological grandiosity, you know, people would be delighted to go from Albany to Chicago at 100 miles an hour, which was state of the art in 1923. You know, they'd be delighted if the train ran on time, ran on schedule, left when it said it was going to leave, got there when it was said it was going to get there, and if the stations were not like public toilets. Okay? These are important things that have to be part of the deal. But we're not willing to do that. And most of the American public, when they're polled, they're violently against putting any money into the railroad system in America. And we got to get over that.
I want to just like a little hopium, optimism.
The pills, Amtrak, pills are outside, right?
Just, we've got bottles of
And especially the Tea Party and the Republican Party.
Just 2 days ago, I saw that Amtrak ridership is at an all-time high now. So people are voting with their feet. There's been some great research, too, with the T4 people down in D.C., Smart Growth America. polling research showing that people prefer, strongly prefer, walkable, bikeable, transit-oriented lifestyles, especially seniors now aging in place. Remember I was talking about that new coalition? AARP, huge, huge. We've been working with them in New York to redesign streets that are safe for seniors, for areas of the city where people need more time to cross the street, they want lower vehicle speeds. So I think, you know, seniors aging in place, young people wanting TOD, Amtrak ridership at an all-time high, you know, we can get this done.
Great. I've got a couple more questions, then we're going to ask some questions from the audience, so bear with us here. I want to know from our two panelists here, what do you think what we've just talked about means for this community? Here we are in Saratoga Springs, the Capital Region. We've talked about some things that are in some more global or bigger framework. What, Jim, I'll let you start. What should we do here locally, or could we do locally here?
Well, I've got two things that jump out right away. One is, to me, amazing situation that no politician in town, as far as I know, has invested any thought or effort in the idea that if we don't get the rail system ramped up so you can bring tourists to Saratoga Springs by other means than motoring, then the tourist economy is going to fall apart in short order. I have no idea why our leaders do not think about this or do not talk about it, but we're not talking about it. We have to improve the service between Albany and Saratoga. And it's got to become a political issue because the life of this town really depends on it.
And I, fans out there, it's good.
The other one is a little embarrassing, is that, you know, we have one of the leading bicycle and pedestrian transportation designers in America living in our town. He's been a friend of mine for 20 years, and it mystifies me that the city of Saratoga has not employed him to help build bicycle infrastructure.
You want the job?
We have fewer miles of bike trail.
Thank you. That.
We have fewer miles of bike trail than dumpy little towns in Kansas and Kentucky. You know, this is a town of this caliber should have a decent bike system and a trail system, and we don't. And it's just it's mystifying. So ask your local politicians that question.
All those in favor, say aye. Anybody? Okay, good. Paul.
You know, I
about me working here. I meant the bike system. We really need to do this. And I'm working in, I wouldn't call them dumpy little towns. Check out what's going on in Bentonville, Arkansas. How many people have been to Bentonville? Okay, soon to be one of the great downtowns in this country. And if we can't keep up with Bentonville, Arkansas, Saratoga Springs really better start thinking hard. I'll give you just a snapshot. Yes, it is the home of Walmart Corporation. Their corporate headquarters is within walking distance of their downtown. Our new chip fab is a drive-in only facility. They are about to open on 11-11-11, the largest new museum in the United States, the Crystal Bridges Museum of Modern Art, of American Art, designed by Moshe Sadfi, surrounded by hundreds of acres that were privately donated by the same family that's created the museum. Those hundreds of acres are laced with the best single-track mountain bike trails ever built. It is spectacular. 100 miles of brand new single track around the museum. A greenway runs right down the center of it, connects to their town square, where they're building a brand new art museum hotel, and the square is completely renovated now. That's Bentonville, Arkansas. Okay? They're investing $30 million there in a new greenway that would be the equivalent of going from Albany to Glens Falls with a new path in a single project. All we built in the next 2 years.
And this is a place where people only wear one suspender on their pants.
Some of them. All I'm trying to say is, if places like that are doing the kinds of things that we dream about, and they're making it happen, and we're supposed to be one of the best towns in the country, and I think we should be one of the best towns in the world, we should watch what the competition's doing, learn from them, and do it better, smarter, and faster. Paul.
I haven't even spent a night here, so I'm not going to venture to say what you should do. Maybe I'll wait till tomorrow for that. But maybe this is a good question for the audience. I'm sure there's some great ideas from people who live here, work here, go to school here.
Hey, everyone. It's Duncan again. I'm going to just cut in. I'm not going to play all of the audience questions or Jim and Paul's response to them. Although they were great, the audio quality is a little bit difficult to decipher. But I'm going to skip ahead right now to the answer to the final question from the audience. And the question was, there are a lot of major transit projects either underway or planned for the near future in New York City and other places. But does it make sense to invest money in these huge mega projects right now if economic activity will be shrinking in the near future, as Jim believes it will during the long emergency?
A lot of what this implies has to do with reallocating what resources we do have. We are not going to be without resources, but we have to redirect them. And if you just, you know, use your imagination and think of what America looks like every night at 5:30 in Dallas and Minneapolis and Atlanta and Los Angeles and the Bay Area and Chicago, and imagine all those freeways jammed with cars running on gasoline, and imagine the allocation of resources and money and wealth that is represented by all of those trips that are being made every single day, twice a day, and then all day long in between. I think we get an idea of really how much, how many resources remain for us to reallocate. So this is a sort of a comprehensive contraction, but not to the degree that we're going to have nothing. We'll still have quite a bit for quite a while, but we have to put it in the right place.
Paul. You know, I met with your congressman last month, Joseph Crowley, and one of his big priorities is simply putting some rail stations on some existing Metro North lines that run right through Queens, but don't stop. Because if you live in some parts of your borough, you have a longer commute to Manhattan than people do in Connecticut, right? Which is ridiculous. So I think that's a good thing when we use our existing rail infrastructure. And put the new station at Yankee Stadium has bankrupted a local parking garage because no one drives to the game anymore because they can just take the train. So there are these like little success stories. And I think the Second Avenue subway, East Side Access, a lot of these mega projects do make sense as long as New York is alive and kicking, which I think it will be for many more decades. Thank you. Yeah. But I think the future is really with buses. Curitiba was mentioned. Bogota has bus rapid transit corridors that move more passengers per hour than subways do, our busiest subway lines in New York City. They do it because they've made the political choice to give that street space to articulated high occupancy buses. So we've seen BRT start to emerge on 1st and 2nd Avenue. It'll be on Nostrand in Brooklyn next year. Fordham Road in the Bronx operates more like a rail system in its headways and in its passenger service. So that's an example of doing more with less.
And what I'm going to do, I'm going to try and wrap things up. It is just about 7:30, and I wanted to get one more question in to both of our speakers, and then we'll summarize. And the question, simply put, we came here tonight to talk about the future. And Jim, this comes from a conversation we had last week. I'd like each of you to just try to respond to, is there a reason for either optimism or pessimism?
I greet this question almost every time I go out and do an event.
That's why I asked him.
And I just have to say this. I'm not a pessimist. I'm not an optimist. I'm a reality-based person. I'm interested in reality. And I think that reality has mandates of its own. Reality is going to compel us to do things whether we like it or not. And reality is going to probably drag the United States into its future kicking and screaming. But it's not about whether you feel bad or feel good, or if I'm making people feel bad or feel good. I suppose my pet argument is simply this. It's not about our feelings. We've been a very narcissistic generation. It's not about your feelings. And the time for being crybabies in America is over. So get over it and get on. Put your shoulder to the wheel and get stuff done.
I told you this would be fun. Paul, go ahead.
You know, 80% of Americans live in a metropolitan area. You know, when you look at that map of America on election day and you see all those red states, right? It looks like, you know, everyone's, you know, living in Montana or in North Dakota. The fact of the matter is that most people in America are already living in cities where driving trips, average driving trips, are 2 to 3 miles. So suburbia and most of America is not as car dependent as one might think. When gas starts to creep up to $5, $6, $7 a gallon, I'm sure it's going to happen. To answer your question, and I think no one really knows when peak oil is going to start rearing its head right then, but every crisis there's an opportunity. So I think all of us in this room are obviously engaged. You're here tonight. Whether the big crunch or the contraction turns into an apocalyptic future or a more optimistic one where we pick ourselves up and go on to the next thing. We decide that. You decide that by how politically engaged you are. So keep it up.
Thank you, Paul. With that said, I get the last two words are on the screen behind me. Thank you to Skidmore College. Thank you to everyone here tonight who is helping to make this change happen. Many of you here and many of us here put a lot of our lives and a lot of our volunteer effort and time and energy into making this kind of change happen. And thank you very much for that. I do hope that if this is the second year we've done something like this here at Skidmore, I can only hope there's a third. And we'll see you all soon. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Kunstler Cast featuring James Howard Kunstler. To leave a listener comment, call toll-free at 866-924-9499. Send email to letters@kunstlercast.com. You can listen to all of our past programs, join our email list, find out how to book Jim to speak in your area, and talk about the show with other listeners at kunstlercast.com. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.